Hello and welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
What older people might think of as plagiarism, younger people may not be, because they're used to seeing knowledge that's out in the public sphere as available for their appropriation.
As our newest third-level students are settling into college, we take a look at a problem they must learn to avoid if they are to work with integrity. We find out about plagiarism. We'll also have a look at why many students from abroad visit Ireland each summer, and it's not to learn English. But we begin with the fourth instalment in Barry Hennessy's series investigating the PISA test of reading, maths and science literacy.
In this series, we've heard how the results of the PISA tests in reading, maths and science have often been seen as a call to action in countries whose scores have declined. Curricular reform and increased attention to literacy and numeracy have gone hand in hand with alarm in media and political circles that the education systems in some countries have been failing the needs of students. But what of those countries that consistently tend to record average or even below average performances? The United States is one country whose PISA score is consistently very average. Emily Richardson is a US education journalist and public editor of the National Education Writers Association. So does PISA get much mainstream attention in the United States?
Last year, when the PISA math score showed that Shanghai students were the world leaders, President Obama called it a Sputnik moment for the United States. The fact is that U.S. scores on international tests continue to lag behind other industrialized nations, and that is a source of significant political tension here. The U.S. is currently debating an overhaul of its public education laws, and closing achievement gaps among minorities, improving college completion rates, and readying American students for the challenges of an international job market. Those are all significant factors.
Do we have any idea of the states in the U.S. that perform better in reading, maths and science? I mean, I know the U.S., when the results are published, it comes out as one. But do we know anything about the breakdown state by state or even city by city?
Well, you're right, Barry. The PISA tests are administered to a small number of representative students across the United States. But because the sample size is too small, the OECD, which administers the exams, does not provide us with state-by-state or city-by-city results. However, we do know that scores tend to be higher in states in northeastern United States, which includes places like Massachusetts and New York, and lower in southern states, such as Mississippi. Perhaps more importantly, though, we know that our students who come from low-income families and students who qualify for free meal programs at schools score significantly lower on all standardized tests, both national and international. So when we look at the PISA results, what we see is the social factors account for a much higher percentage of our overall student performance than you would find in many other nations. We know when it comes to demonstrating academic proficiency on PISA, our at-risk students are almost a full year behind their more affluent peers. Another area of concern is our students from one-parent households did far worse than their peers with similar family situations in other countries. And the OECD uses that to measure something it calls resilience. What that means is it's the ability of a student to score relatively well on a standardized test, despite having to overcome social economic challenges like poverty. And a student is considered resilient if they rank among the 25% poorest students in a population, but score in the top 25% on the PISA exam. In the United States, just under 30% of our students were ranked resilient on the last PISA result. But in nations with the highest PISA scores, the resiliency rate was about 70%.
Within the U.S. school system, basically, to what extent is it decentralized? I mean, where does the responsibility of the federal education department stop? How much is decided at state level, at local level?
While the United States has a federal education department, states do have a high degree of autonomy when it comes to how their public schools operate. That makes it difficult for individual states to respond directly to results like PISA when we only have national and regional data. How do you tell a state like New York or at the other end of the country, California, to improve their schools based on results that they can't point directly to their own students? However, federal, state, and local education officials all are talking about the need for American students to compete internationally, And the relatively unimpressive PISA scores in the United States are often cited as evidence that our students are falling behind. There's a new initiative underway right now. It's known as Race to the Top. And what it's doing is it's encouraging states to more aggressively tackle persistent education problems in exchange for federal funding. This includes revamping teacher licensing policies, turning around lowest performing schools, and encouraging stronger partnerships with community organizations to provide some of those support social services to make up for the deficits that we've talked about that students may be experiencing in their home lives or in their communities. We're also seeing a new emphasis on early childhood education to make sure students are ready to learn when they start school and start off with a strong foundation. The newest initiative that we're seeing right now has to do with the quality of instruction in a classroom. Research has confirmed that the quality of the teacher is probably the single biggest predictor of whether or not a student is going to succeed. But in the United States, students who enter teacher training programs are typically coming from the bottom 25% of their graduating class. Arne Duncan, our education secretary, he's pointed out that in nations with the highest PISA scores, teachers are recruited from the top third of a school's students. In Finland, which, as we all know, has one of the world's best track records and international exams, they're even more selective. They draw their teachers from the top 10% of their students. So national studies have shown us that we know that our teachers and our teacher training programs are probably falling short. As a result, we're seeing lower student achievement. And the focus right now is on improving the quality of classroom instruction, support for teachers, raising the rigor of the academic standards, and increasing expectations. And I think that's something that's a shared responsibility among lawmakers at the state, national, and local level, community leaders, educators, parents, and I would say even the students themselves.
And that was Emily Richardson closing Barry Hennessy's report on PISA for this week. Barry will continue the series on next week's programme. Many of us are familiar with the hordes of students from Spain, France, Italy, Japan and further afield who come to Ireland every summer to learn English. But we may be less familiar with English-speaking students who travel to Ireland from the United States and elsewhere to learn about Ireland's rich culture and heritage, including the Irish language. To learn more about this, Inside Education reporter Sinead Burke spoke to Róisín Ní Nia of the Merino Institute of Education about the field of Irish studies. Sinead first asked Róisín why US students travel to countries such as Ireland to take courses in Irish studies.
Well, for American students, the aim of the study abroad programmes is to get young US students in touch with what's going on around the world, to broaden their horizons a little bit, to realise that international relations just don't happen at the level of diplomacy of diplomats and foreign ministers, etc., that it happens through people on the ground talking to people from one country and another, talking to people in another country. I think that's the biggest benefit for the students coming, that they can broaden their horizons, that they can experience a different culture, perhaps a different language, a different way of life. And they learn a certain amount on the course, through the course of studies that has been organised for them, but they learn an awful lot more through the interaction they will have by going out and enjoying themselves, having a social evening, going into Temple Bar, which was very, very popular with them this year, going on trips around Ireland, visiting various cities like Kilkenny or Cork or somewhere else.
Why should they come to Ireland rather than England or Spain?
Well, I think because of the rich culture and heritage that we have here, and a lot of American students do have connections with Ireland. They have Irish roots, and maybe they're a few generations away from that. But I think there is a huge market there for Irish American students with an Irish American background to come to Ireland. And I don't think we've tapped into that half enough. And we have a reputation for having high quality education services here. And we need to maintain that, of course.
And around the country, there are various institutions and universities offering such courses. What are the differences or similarities between the various educational institutions?
Well, most of them offer, say, Irish language, culture and heritage in some form or another. And they all offer that. Some venues, like I think Galway offers law in Ireland or business in Ireland. And that's something we don't offer in Merino because that's not our strength. So we stick to what we're good at. We have two study abroad programs running in Marino. One is a semester abroad where the students come in January and they stay for a semester. I think they leave around the beginning of May. And that course goes back about 25 years, a long time running. But we have developed a new course, which is just a shorter summer course, running from this year, from the 22nd of May till the 23rd of June. And again, it's aimed at students from the USA. And the course is accredited by Iona College, New Rochelle, New York. And for completing two modules of the course, two programmes, the students will get 6 credits.
And in a course like Irish Studies, what will such students study?
Well, while they're here, we offer a menu of 5 courses. We offer Irish language and heritage. That's one course. There are 2 strands to that course. One is the Irish language itself, Gaeilge, and the other is learning all aspects of Irish heritage. The next course we would offer is politics and conflict in Ireland, and that goes to the history of conflict in Northern Ireland and the actual conflict itself from the 70s onwards, and then the peace process and the resolution and mediation of the peace process. We also offer the arts in Ireland, religion and spirituality. And we also offer language and literature, where students can learn all about Irish writers and Irish literature.
Those subjects are quite specific. What attracts the American students to come over here and study such subjects?
Of all of the study abroad locations that Americans will go to, generally speaking, they're English language countries where English language is spoken. The top destination for students is the UK, and Ireland ranks 9th, which isn't too bad for a small country of our size. Other destinations that they would go to would be Italy, Spain, France, China, Australia. Sometimes the courses they are studying, particularly last year, we had only 6 students, but of them, 4 of them were doing international studies. So they're attracted by the course, that particular course, depending on what they're studying at home themselves. If it ties in with their own programme of studies at home, then they're interested in coming.
And what would the average fee be for providing such a course or enrolling in such a course?
Well, the fee includes everything when they come. It includes their accommodation and their food and their tuition. The fee for this year is $3,999, $4,000 for 4 weeks in Ireland. It also includes tours and trips and entrances to places like museums and galleries and so on. The only thing it doesn't include is the flight here. We've got our own website, www.mie.ie, or we've got Irish Studies Dublin website as well. We'll bring them straight into the Irish Studies page.
And that was Róisín Nínia from the Marino Institute of Education closing Sinead Burke's report on Irish Studies. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, which is insideed.com. Among many terms and labels that I've seen put on students today, one that has stuck in my mind is that they are the cut and paste generation. But there is a risk to cutting and pasting. You might remember that when Enda Kenny welcomed President Barack Obama here earlier this year, he borrowed substantially from the US President's victory speech on his election night to welcome President Obama. Enda Kenny was criticised in the media for a while, and that was the end of it. But plagiarism at college level can have more serious consequences for a student's academic career. One person who has studied the area of plagiarism at college level is Professor Thomas S. Dee. Professor D is a professor of public policy and economics and a research professor of education at the University of Virginia in the United States. Along with Professor Brian Jacob from the University of Michigan, he has written a paper called Rational Ignorance in Education, a Field Experiment in Student Plagiarism. I spoke to Professor D recently, and this week I bring you the first part of that interview. First of all, Thomas D told me what plagiarism is.
Well, you know, in the U.S., when people discuss plagiarism, they generally have in mind the appropriation of someone's ideas, or particularly in the context of student writing, the concern is around the appropriation of someone's text. And that's where most of the concern in the ed policy field, at least in the United States, has been focused, you know, both among students, but also among, there have been several high-profile scandals in the U.S. involving prominent public intellectuals whose books have included appropriated texts without proper citation to the original source.
That's interesting. Indeed, we had a similar example here ourselves when your president visited our country and our Taoiseach introduced him by largely plagiarising Obama's acceptance speech when he won. That would be an example of plagiarism, right?
That's right. And I think there's an old epigram about, you know, curse those who've had our good thoughts before us, that people who plagiarize sometimes invoke. But no, that's right. There have been a number of scandals, and also with political leaders in the U.S. The current Vice President Joe Biden, I think, was once caught out plagiarizing the text of, I believe, Neil Kinnock, a politician in the U.K. So it happens a lot. But I think in the ed policy sphere, what's really kind of motivated the current concern is this confluence of new computer software that has changed how we write, and the interaction of that with unprecedented access to full text resources. And I think it would be hard for perhaps some of your younger listeners to reckon with what it was like to engage in the act of research and writing just 20 short years ago. And I'm old enough to sort of remember what it was like before we had really sophisticated word processing software, as well as sort of extensive access to full text resources. And so what's created a lot of wringing of hands now is this notion that now that people can easily engage in sort of cut and paste kinds of writing, that we might, the prevalence of plagiarism may be much higher, and it may have even shifted back into sort of the social norms and how people understand what plagiarism is. The basic idea is that, or the concern out there is that what older people might think of as plagiarism, younger people may not be, because they're used to seeing knowledge that's out in the public sphere as available for their appropriation.
So then that prompts the next question, which somebody of that age may ask, what's wrong with it? Why is plagiarism wrong?
Well, that's actually an interesting question, and one in which people in my discipline, economics, have thought about. You know, one of the examples that's used in a prominent book is the a discussion around the work of Shakespeare and his play Antony and Cleopatra, which really borrows extensively from some of the historical texts that were available from that period. And that's offered up as an example of plagiarism that's not particularly terrible, because it's a kind of a pedigreed form of creativity. And I think this happens also in modern music and sort of genres like hip-hop, where people sample older music creatively. There's a sense in which that's plagiarism, but it's, you know, from an economics lens, it's not necessarily harmful, because there's also value added there, and it's not creating what legal scholars will call a detrimental reliance on the part of the consumer, where they're thinking they're consuming a form of original intellectual product that in fact is not original. In those cases, people know that there's some sort of melange of old and new that's going on. Where plagiarism is problematic is where it's compromising the accumulation of human capital, where students are, and indeed sort of adult writers, are using it as a crutch, and where it's being presented to either one's teachers or to the general public as original intellectual product, when it's, in fact it is not.
So if I'm to summarize then what you're saying, it's okay to sample from someone else's work, provided you do something creative with it, and presumably provided you acknowledge it.
That's right. And I think, I mean, you know, everyone can use their own moral compass. I don't want to tell people what's right. But there's the argument out there that when you sort of sample creatively, and it's again, a sort of pedigreed form of creativity that's common going back centuries upon centuries. But I think in the sort of modern discourse, particularly one that would be relevant for your audience, which I presume is mostly interested in issues around education and education policy, it's really around what's going on with our students now. And, you know, a younger generation that has grown up in this sort of unusual set of circumstances where, you know, all sorts of full-text resources are available, as well as access to word processing software.
Now, obviously, the situation in the United States may be different to Ireland, but how big a problem is plagiarism at college in the United States?
Well, this is where I wanted to stress some caveats, because certainly if you were to look at the kind of wringing of hands and gnashing of teeth, you would think it's incredibly prevalent. My view, though, based on the evidence I've seen, including my own research, is we don't entirely know. I mean, because plagiarism is an illicit behavior, we don't really have very good data on it. There are a number of surveys that would simply ask students how often they plagiarize. But, you know, those surveys suffer from low response rates, the selectivity of the institutions, and the fact that the students themselves don't necessarily understand what plagiarism is. Now, one of the virtues, I think, of the work I've been doing with my colleague Brian Jacob at the University of Michigan is that we've gone about, at least for the one institution we've studied to date, exhaustively collecting papers that students have submitted and using sort of sophisticated computer algorithms to evaluate them for plagiarized content. And so there we've got an objective measure that's not based on potentially problematic or non-representative self-reports. And our original research focused on one selective post-secondary institution, and plagiarism actually wasn't that common there. We found it in about 3-4% of papers, and it tended to be of the variety that people would call mosaic plagiarism, where students aren't appropriating whole papers or even whole paragraphs from source material, but instead certain sentence clauses and phrases are being lifted without attribution. And so what that suggested to us, and we had some other ancillary evidence that supported this, is that students may be doing this somewhat unintentionally through sort of sloppy research and writing practices. You know, they're collecting source material, they're reshaping it as they form their papers, and as that iterative process reaches its conclusion, they're sometimes forgetting to source and cite you know, the text written by others.
So then, Tom, is the problem that these students are not being taught how to cite the work of others, and that they're not actually learning this from the people who should be teaching them, namely their college lecturers?
I think that's right. I mean, so I should describe a little more exactly what we did in our research to kind of frame that. I mean, we went to 28 college classrooms that had over 600 students, where nearly 1,300 papers were submitted, and without student awareness that we were doing this, we electronically collected the papers and analyzed them. But we also assigned a random half of those classrooms to have a required instructional tutorial, an online tutorial that students had to complete early in the semester. That was essentially this sort of, you know, richly detailed introduction to what plagiarism is and what are the practical mechanisms for avoiding it. And basically, what we found was that exposure to the tutorial was incredibly effective in reducing the prevalence of plagiarism. Now, the thing is, why exactly might a tutorial like that work? Well, one explanation is the one suggested in your question, that we gave students the tools they needed to avoid it. They were well-intentioned, but they simply didn't know exactly what plagiarism was and how they could avoid it in their work. Now, another sort of more cynical interpretation of those results is that we simply scared the students straight, that there was a deterrent effect from being exposed to the tutorial. So we conducted a ex post survey of the students who participated in this randomized trial that tried to suss out whether we had, you know, there was a human capital mechanism behind the efficacy of the tutorial, or whether it was a pure deterrence effect. And the evidence really suggested more of a human capital story. Now, I think that's important to know, that there might be kind of low-hanging fruit out there in terms of avoiding plagiarism, in terms of simply giving students the awareness and tools they need to avoid that. Now, at least in the U.S., and perhaps in schools in Ireland as well, there's an implementation problem around this, though. College instructors like me are a big impediment to doing this, because when we're teaching students in our core subjects, you know, for example, me when I'm teaching an economics course or a course in education or public policy, I view my core responsibility as conveying the material to the students and engaging them in that material. I don't necessarily see my core responsibility as teaching students about academic integrity. That part of their instruction, an important part of their instruction, is kind of a public good. And I think in many schools and universities, we've got what's sometimes called a tragedy of the commons, because students need those skills, but no one teacher sees it as their responsibility to really convey that well. So I think that leads us to kind of an equilibrium where teachers don't teach how to write with integrity. They don't police how to write, the writing and whether there's plagiarism in it. And so students sort of become aware of that and don't necessarily invest much time in figuring out on their own how to write with academic integrity. So that's why you'll see this phrase in some of our work. We refer to this phenomenon as rational ignorance. Your students don't necessarily know what plagiarism is or how to avoid it, and they have really weakly powered incentives to address that deficiency, given the sort of environment that their instructors present them with.
I really like that idea of the tragedy of the commons. I think my grandmother would have said, "What's everyone's job is no one's job." Well, next week, I'll bring you the second part of the interview with Professor Thomas S.D. when he'll tell me what lecturers and students can do to reduce the incidence of plagiarism. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programs on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guests, Professor Thomas S.D. from the University of Virginia, to Emily Richardson, and to my colleagues Barry Hennessy and Sinead Burke. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.